Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 544, titled The Return of the Standard IG Agreement of 1929. This is being recorded on March 12th of 2006, and in turn, this broadcast is going to consist, or it already does consist, in large measure of a recapitulation of For the Record 506 from April 10th of 2005. The reason we're recapitulating that program is to look at the Standard IG Agreement of 1929, the focal point on the various permutations of the hydrogenation technology used to derive synthetic oil and fuel. That technology was the focal point of the Standard IG Agreement, and we have been looking at a number of interesting maneuvers involving the Thiessen firm, Standard Oil, IG Farben, oil shortages real and imagined, and later on we're going to take a look at the reviving of the hydrogenation process, or a permutation thereof, because once again, as I had been, foreshadowing, I guess, rather than predicting in no uncertain terms, the maneuvering that I've been looking at does appear to be leading up to the reviving of the IG Farben Standard Oil synthetic fuel technologies, which have remained dormant since the end of World War II, except for their application in apartheid South Africa, itself an offshoot of Nazi Germany. Here is Side 1 and For the Record 506 from April 10th of 2005. And what we're going to do now is to once again resume with the tale of the Leuna facility. You're going to hear an excerpt to begin, a pretty long excerpt from For the Record program number 278. For the Record program 278 was recorded in the spring of 2001, and we're going to be listening to some discussion of the Leuna plant. By the way, at that point in time, I didn't know how that was pronounced. I thought it was pronounced Leuna, but it's actually pronounced Leuna, L-E-U-N-A. Nonetheless, we're going to hear once again an excerpt from the book The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borkin about a critical air engagement of World War II, namely what was called by the 8th Air Force the Battle of Leuna. Specifically, one of the key elements in knocking out German industrial production was neutralizing its fuel production capability. And again, synthetic oil developed by the Bergius process developed by the Germany's synthetic oil plants provided most of Germany's fuel in World War II. It wasn't economically competitive with natural oil at the time due to the low price of oil and the relative inefficiency of the process. Germany was able to make up for that economically by the use of slave labor. Again, in For the Record 385, I voiced my opinion that quote, novel, unquote, the formula by Steve Shagan was, in fact, the disclosure of sensitive intelligence information that could not be overtly disseminated, and indeed other of Shagan's novels appear to be a similar thing, sort of like what was seen in the movie 3 Days of the Condor, featuring Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway. The notion that the Bergius process, the hydrogenation process, has not in any way been improved since 1929 simply defies belief, given the significance of the 1929 Standard IG Agreement and the pivotal importance of petroleum in the world's industrial economy. We're going to be listening in the following segment of For the Record 278, again recorded in the spring of 2000, actually the late winter of 2001. We're going to be hearing a number of things. After the discussion of the Battle of Leuna from The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, we're going to be listening to an excerpt of an article from the New York Times, Big Kickbacks Under Coal, reported by Roger Cohen and John Taliabu. That from the New York Times of February 7th of 2000. And we're going to be listening to discussion of the interrelationship between the Thiessen firm and the Total ELF firm, then ELF Aquitaine, in purchasing the rebuilt Leuna facility after World War II. It was bombed in World War II, the Soviets rebuilt it, and in the early 90s, that Leuna facility, the same one you heard discussed in part one of this broadcast, was the focal point of a major element of maneuvering between powerful political and economic interests. Disclosure of that brought down Helmut Kohl. But the important thing is that the Leuna facility was, once again, the focal point of major activity. We should note in this regard that the Leuna facility can also be used for other things. The high pressure process can be used to develop nitrates for the production of fertilizer and other things. But I suspect very strongly that in the maneuvering around the Leuna facility, we are looking at a partial recapitulation of the Standard OIG agreement of 1929. And it may very well be that the quote peak oil controversy unquote is intended not only to affect some very serious worldwide machinations, including getting rid of a lot of folks, but also to rehabilitate the Standard IG agreement and to realize the potential of that powerful cartel agreement from 1929. We're also going to hear information from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, reviewing the connection between the Thyssen firm, which helped to buy the Leuna facility, and the Underground Reich and the Bormann Group, and the Bush family. So here is an excerpt from For the Record program number 278 from the winter of 2001. We're going to turn now to one of the best books about I.G. Farben. It's titled The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, authored by Joseph Borken, published in hardcover by the Free Press, a division of Macmillan, copyright 1978, ISBN 0-02-904630-0. And of the Leuna refinery and its destruction in May of 1944, this being called the Battle of Leuna, we read as follows. May 12, 1944 was a fateful day for Germany and for IG. On that day, the United States 8th Air Force sent 935 bombers over Germany to attack its synthetic oil industry. 200 bombers concentrated on IG's Leuna plant alone. This attack marked the beginning of what the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey called the Battle of Leuna, classifying it as one of the major battles of the war, unquote, and skipping down of the report to Hitler of an IG Farben official named Kroc. He told Hitler that Germany's position was hopeless if the enemy air raids on the synthetic oil plants continued. To support his grim forecast, he presented Hitler with an impressive array of facts and figures, skipping down. The only thing to do was to try to put the plants back in operation as quickly as possible, and then protect them with a heavy defensive air cover. Speer gave the restoration project the highest priority for men and materiel. 350,000 workers were assigned to the task of restoring German oil production. At Leuna, the effort succeeded in bringing the facilities back to partial operation within 10 days, but on May 28th, the 8th Air Force resumed the Battle of Leuna. The result was another crippling blow, which reduced German fuel production by half. By the way, the Speer referred to there is German Armaments Minister Albert Speer. Continuing. And skipping down, the course of the Battle of Leuna became the gauge for the state of German oil production. By early July, the resourceful IG technicians were able to restore Leuna to 75% operating capacity. However, the 8th Air Force returned again on July 7th, again bombing the plant to a halt. 2 days later, the plant started operating again and by July 19th had reached 53% of capacity. And so the cycle of bombings and reconstruction continued. But the total effect on German fuel production was nothing less than catastrophic. Kroc concluded that the only way fuel installations could be rebuilt after each raid was to cannibalize other installations. Under this plan to prevent the total cessation of oil production, Germany's productive capacity diminished with each recuperation. By September, oil production had dropped to 15%, a condition from which Germany was never to recover. And that again from The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben about the history of the Leuna refinery in World War II. Now we're going to reprise a section of For the Record program number 193. This in turn is an excerpt of a New York Times article about the role of the Leuna refinery in the CDU funding scandal. And we're going to hear a couple of interesting names, bearing in mind the dizzying connection that the many connections between the dots that we have already covered. This again from For the Record program number 193.
Bernard Gorny, G-O-R-N-Y, Mr. Guillon's lawyer, declined to comment. On the same day that Nobelpac received the money in 1992, it wired 220 million francs, or $33.8 million, to a company registered in Liechtenstein called Standby Establishment, and the remaining $5.2 million to the Swiss account of a company called Showfast Limited. Swiss prosecutors say both companies appeared to be controlled by Mr. Letier and Mr. Holzer, who have not denied receiving the sums. The money was later moved, at least in part, to Liechtenstein foundations. Paul Perraudin, a Geneva prosecutor, has told Le Monde that one foundation, Delta International, is believed to be a front for Mr. Holzer's activities. Another, Foundation Thais, T-H-A-I-S, is thought to be a front for Mr. Letier. Some of these accounts were frozen in January. Swiss and French prosecutors believe that Mr. Gelfi received more than $4 million for his services. Those included a second use of this company in 1993, with a payment of over $20 million by Thiessen in connection with its partnership with ELF in certain projects at Leuna. Mr. Gelfi justified the payment, bringing total commissions paid to about $60 million by producing false, quote, feasibility studies, unquote. At the groundbreaking ceremony for the new Leuna refinery in 1994, Mr. Kohl called it, quote, the most important Franco-German industrial project since World War II, unquote. He did not explain why. So again, note this dizzying tangle of corporate fronts. Note also that in addition to being the company that manufactured the tanks in this Saudi Arabian tank deal that is one of the sources of these mysterious monies, note also that Thiessen apparently was involved with certain projects with ELF at the Leuna refinery. So again, the Thiessen Group, not only one of the main elements in German heavy industry, but one of the central tiles, so to speak, in the mosaic of the Bormann organization, figures in both the tank and the ELF refinery deal at Leuna. That, again, is from For the Record program number 193. Now, bearing in mind the Thiessen involvement with Leuna Refinery, I mispronounced that, and bear in mind also the CDU funding scandal, and that was the focal point of 193, we're going to return once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. Now, of the role of I.G. Farben in the Bormann organization, Paul Manning writes as follows. The Bormann organization continues to wield enormous economic influence. Wealth continues to flow into the treasuries of its corporate entities in South America, the United States, and Europe. Vastly diversified, it is said to be the largest landowner in South America, and through stock holdings controls German heavy industry and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmitz, former president of IG Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers. Now, note, too, that the Thiessen Group is one of the principal elements in the Bormann organization, as we've looked at in numerous broadcasts, resuming now, for the purposes of review, discussion of the Bormann Group and Thiessen, turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, of the post-war fate of the Thiessen industrial empire and its connections with the Bormann Group, we read, during the final year of his life in Argentina, dividing his time between the villa in Buenos Aires and the ranches, one in Argentina, the other in Paraguay, Fritz Thiessen completed establishing the control that would assure everlasting family prosperity through Thiessen AG. Elder grandson Count Federico Zichy Thiessen of Buenos Aires was placed on the board of this German steel trust. When the Count votes at board meetings in Dusseldorf three or four times a year, he votes for the entire Thiessen family of South America and Europe. Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, who has a younger brother, Count Claudio Zichy Thiessen, represents the largest single shareholding group with 25% of the stock in Thiessen AG. The remainder of the stock is diffused into Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt and Buenos Aires, which holds shares for many individuals on both continents, including those representing the Bormann Group. So note the connection between the Bormann Group and Thiessen AG. And of the close connection between Martin Bormann himself and the Thiessen family, we read once again from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by way of review. Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, grandson of old Fritz Thiessen, Claudio Zichy Thiessen, and their families are intimate friends of Bormann. Because of this friendship, Martin Bormann has three sanctuaries, his own pompous spread in Argentina, and the Thiessen ranches in Argentina and Paraguay. By the way, pompous is P-A-M-P-A-S. We're going to turn now to an excerpt of For the Record program number 273. This deals with the Bush family and the Union Banking Corporation and the Thiessens. This is from For the Record program number 273, B as in Bush, B as in Borman. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Sarasota Herald Tribune of Saturday, November 11th of the year 2000. This is an article put together by the Sarasota Herald Tribune staff headlined "Author Links Bush Family to Nazis." And this was accessed from their website, that is to say the Sarasota Herald Tribune website at www.newscoast.com. This reads in part as follows. Now, the main element here is the Union Banking Corporation and the Bush family, and as it develops, the Bush family fortune comes from the post-war liquidation of the Union Bank in 1951. The article reads, again, Sarasota Herald Tribune, 11-11-2000. The president of the Florida Holocaust Museum said Saturday that George W. Bush's grandfather derived a portion of his personal fortune through his affiliation with a Nazi-controlled bank. John Loftus, a former prosecutor in the Justice Department's Nazi War Crimes Unit, said his research found that Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, was a principal in the Union Banking Corporation in Manhattan in the late 1930s and the 1940s. Now, here's the really important part here. That is by way of review for veteran listeners. Listen to this. Leading Nazi industrialists secretly owned the bank at that time, Loftus said, and were moving money into it through a second bank in Holland even after the United States declared war on Germany. The bank was liquidated in 1951, Loftus said, and Bush's grandfather and great-grandfather received $1.5 million from the bank as part of that dissolution. Quote, "That's where the Bush family fortune came from. It came from the Third Reich," unquote, Loftus said.
Now, again, an excerpt from For the Record program number 278. What we're going to do next is to take a look at some information that we looked at in For the Record 478, and specifically we're going to look at some information from the article, The Coming Panic Over the End of Oil, Coming to a Ballot Box Near You. This was posted on Scoop, an online publication. It was authored by the late Walter Shaysby and posted on December 24th of the year 2003. Now, one of the things Shaysby tackles here is that the peak oil controversy, or the peak oil advocates, are themselves people who are very much connected to the petroleum industry itself. Although they're not all wild exponents of just ripping the whole earth apart in order to get all the oil we can. Basically, when we're looking at the peak oil controversy, what we're looking at basically is the foxes guarding the hen house and saying, my goodness, we're running out of hens. That's really not an inaccurate situation at all. And we're going to take a look at Contreras's situation here, basically Walter Shaysby's discussion here. One of the primary advocates of the peak oil situation is a fellow named Matthew E. Simmons. Walter Shaysby writes, well, guess what? Simmons is not only an oilionaire himself, but has been a key advisor to the Bush administration and to Vice President Cheney's 2001 Energy Task Force, as well as sitting on the Council of Foreign Relations. Simmons is a board member of Kerr-McGee Corporation, a major oil and gas producer. He insists that the U.S. government is very worried about oil depletion. However, Cheney's secretive National Energy Policy Development Group, or NEPDG, refused to make its records of closed-door meetings with industry executives public. The industry has taken a beating in public opinion since the Kyoto summit put the spotlight on global warming. And now Simmons apparently wants to make the public's fear of the end of cheap oil the drumbeat of the 2004 re-elect Bush and Cheney campaign, although a more enlightened energy policy, he worries, quote, is going to take a while, unquote.
What we're going to look at next is a petroleum industry consulting group that is the epicenter for the peak oil advocacy position. We know that peak oil was first proposed by a guy named Marion King Hubert, who died in 1989, who accurately forecast the diminution of domestic petroleum reserves in the U.S. But note, now bearing in mind the Thiessen firm's maneuvering in purchasing the Leuna facility in the early 1990s, we're going to take a look now at the relationship between Petro Consultants of Geneva, which became HIS, and this is the epicenter of the peak oil advocacy situation, and HIS is a wholly owned energy consulting subsidiary of Thiessen Bornemisza Industries, turning once again to Walter Shaysby's paper. Support for a remedial program of oil exploration and development versus switching to research and development of alternative energy sources tends to be found among oil experts who are consultants to the industry. While accepting some of the values of the New Age, they largely remain loyal to their calling as oil geologists and wildcatters. The leading trio of John H. Leherrer, Colin J. Campbell, and L.F. Buzz Ivanoe have worked for or with the leading firm modeling oil fields, Petro Consultants of Geneva. Note very carefully who feeds the data to Petro Consultants, later HIS, from which they produce their conclusions that we're running out of oil. Note this very carefully. Since the 1950s, they have been fed data on oil exploration and production by just about all the major oil companies, as well as by a network of 2,000 oil industry consultants around the world. They use this data to produce reports on various matters pertinent to the oil industry, which they sell back to the industry. Quote, "This much is known," Kenneth DeFays writes. "The loudest warnings about the predicted peak of world oil production came from Petro Consultants." And still more. In a late 1998 merger, Petro Consultants became HIS Energy Group, a subsidiary of Information Handling Services Group, or HIS Group, a diversified conglomerate owned by Holland America Investment Corporation, HIS Group's immediate parent company, for the Thiessen Bornemisza Group, TBG, Incorporated. In the 1920s, George Herbert Walker and his son-in-law Prescott Bush had helped the Thiessen dynasty finance its acquisitions through Union Banking Corporation and Holland America Trading Corporation. Until his death last year, Hans Heinrich Thiessen Bornemisza, the nephew of the Nazi steel and coal magnate, was one of the world's richest men. Skipping down, in 1995, a report by Campbell and Leherrer on world oil resources, World Oil Supply 1930-2050, written for oil industry insiders and priced at $32,000 per copy, concluded that world oil production and supply would probably peak as soon as the year 2000 and decline to half the peak level by 2025. Large and permanent increase in oil prices were predicted after the year 2000. Skipping down, we're now going to hear some more from Colin J. Campbell, one of the consultants involved with HIS Group, now a subsidiary of Thiessen Bornemisza, and one of the founders of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. Quote, "Campbell has laid out his prescription for various consumer governments. For example, Germany should resist green pressure to give up nuclear power at precisely the moment it needs more energy as oil peaks and declines. Germany has coal and possibilities for coal bed methane. This industry needs to be rediscovered. It may become economic again. Germany should encourage its motor manufacturers to move to more efficient engines and hydrogen fuels, especially those made by solar means." So note that Colin J. Campbell is basically pointing to Germany's coal reserves as an answer to its energy problems. And that, once again, was from Side 2 of For the Record 506, recorded on April 10th of the year 2005. A couple of other items that were mentioned in that broadcast, and which I'm going to touch upon. One of the things that we talked about was the fact that the Rockefeller family, the dominant element in, or really at this point, the co-dominant element in the Standard Oil milieu, along with the Hermann Schmitz Trust,
The Rockefeller family were the second largest investor in ThyssenKrupp behind the Thyssen and related interests. So that basically the Rockefellers stand to benefit from any Thyssen exploitation of the hydrogenation technology and the Leuna facility in the former East Germany. Also, behind the Thyssens and the Rockefellers, the largest stockholder in Thyssen is ThyssenKrupp, is, surprise, surprise, Iran, of all people, the Iranian government. And the Iranian government not only is involved with, obviously, petroleum, but it is also involved with the Muslim Brotherhood and underground Reich milieu that we've looked at in connection with Ahmed Huber, Francois Janoux, and others. So, again, note that behind the Thyssen family and the underground Reich, the Rockefellers and the Iranian government are the second and third largest stockholders, respectively, in Thyssen AG. Now, the reason why we've taken the time that we have to go through not only For the Record 506, but in so doing a number of other broadcasts, is the fact that this past week, an event which I have been looking for and a development that I've been foreshadowing, is in fact now a reality. Namely, it appears that the hydrogenation technology, or a permutation thereof, is now being applied once again, with soaring oil prices having made synthetic fuel a more viable alternative. We're going to take a look now at the GTL process. This is part of the synthetic fuel process, or technology, I should say, developed by IG Farben. The late columnist Jack Anderson, among others, was one of the few who wrote about the fact that this technology has remained largely dormant since the end of World War II, except for its application in apartheid South Africa itself, an outgrowth of the Third Reich, as we've seen in a number of broadcasts. The development that I had been looking for, in fact, was announced in the Financial Times of London of Monday, March 6th of 2006. I read a section of this article at the beginning of the broadcast. This is an article titled "Oil Giants Look to Gas Alternative." It's by Thomas Caton in London, again from the Financial Times of London of Monday, March 6th. A novel way to create an ultra-clean fuel for cars that uses natural gas instead of oil is on the verge of rapid growth, analysts say, driven by soaring oil prices and a thirst for alternative fuels. Oil companies are investing billions of dollars in the nascent technology called gas-to-liquids, or GTL, which can be used to produce quality diesel and a range of other products normally derived from crude. The process was developed in Nazi Germany and apartheid South Africa, but in a few weeks will be tested on a commercial scale for the first time when the largest plant so far opens in Qatar. Skipping down. Car makers are also interested. Royal Dutch Shell is working with Toyota, Volkswagen, and Daimler Chrysler to create vehicles that run on pure GTL diesel, which combines high power with extremely low emissions. And skipping down, Shell and ExxonMobil plan to build much larger GTL plants in Qatar, but other countries are also involved. Nigeria has a plant under construction built by Sasol and Chevron. BP plans to build a plant in Colombia. So the major oil companies, including ExxonMobil and Chevron, all offshoots of the old Standard Oil giant, are involved with this resurrection of the hydrogenation technology, which was at the focal point of the Standard IG agreement of 1929. That is the synfuel technology that was integral to the Nazi industrial process, sort of waiting in the wings as fuel prices accelerated or oil prices accelerated to the point where the technology became viable again. Please do use the various websites, including the Spitfire website, to find out more about these cartel agreements and enhance your understanding. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 544, Return of the Standard IG Agreement of 1929. This has been recorded on March 12th of 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.